Oak Session number 13572, Reel 3.
Pete James, take two. Low level.
Yeah, I left there, and I was posted to Swanton Morley in Norfolk. That was like a operational OTU for Mitchells. And they were all in tents. Some imbecile had come up with tents, because you're going to France. Yeah, you know, I thought myself, what's the matter? Don't they know they've got buildings in France? You know, everybody lives in tents. You know, this is 44, August, September 44. Everybody was in tents. Sergeant Smith, the officer Smith, you were living in tents, you know, because you're going to France, you know. I thought myself, well, don't they know they've got buildings in France? You know, who come up with this stupid idea? Anyway, well, I left there, I was only there about a week or so. And I've got this crew, and they've done a tour, because on a Mitchell there was only a crew of four: pilot, navigator, bomb aimer, two gunners. And both flying officers, both scruffy. I see them, and they're both scruffy blokes, you know. I thought, well, they're doing me, you know. Well, if you're a bit of an outlaw as regards discipline, you know, you know what you're doing up in the air. See, so anyway, I crewed up with these. Bobby Parsons was the pilot, Alfie Law was the navigator, and the other gunner was a bloke named Campbell, Ken Campbell, flight lieutenant. He was, and He'd done 9 on Albemarle, 8 or 9 on Albemarle out of Cairo, you know, 1940. And he'd come home, got a commission, and he'd been adjutant at Yatesbury for 2 years, this bloke. And there was an order come out, late 44. All officers who want to keep the commission after the war have got to do a tour of ops. And we've got a load of them turn up on two group, you know, instructors and all that. They've been instructing 3 or 4 years. They all turned up. You know, we got a wing commander, no op, bloke named Adams, no ops. This is December for October or November. He turned up. You know, hadn't done an op. He's a wing commander. But of course, they'd all been in training command. All these blokes, see, and of course, they got a bit of a shock. You know, when they come through a squadron like, you know, they. Two or three of them turned up, you know, a bit of bullshit with them, you know, they soon lost that, like, you know. And the worst one on Mitchell's, Mitchell's was the same, you know, you were briefed, but you were more or less knocking out bridges and railway marshalling yards and, you know, now and again the army had, and you were bombing in front of the army.
Tactical.
Yeah, tactical, 2nd Tactical Air Force, that's what they call it. And the worst one we'd done there was Munching Gladbeck, right in the middle of the Ruhr, right marshalling yard. Oh, Christ, you know, I thought we were... Low level, we never done a low level. 8,000, 10,000 feet in broad daylight, you know, oh, Christ, you know, you're sitting duck, because you had to go over six of you, like that, see, box of six. And you all named different boxes. We're all named different colour, you know, red box, gold box, white box, blue box. And there were 72 Mitchells and Bostons on most raids, see. And the worst one we'd done was Munching Gladbeck. We were the first one in there at Wright Marshalling Yards, and we were the only ones to come out. 5 of our box got shot. We were the only ones to get back to Vitry. Well, we were based in Vitry then, North France, 226, and moved there in October 44. And
this is anti-aircraft fire, was it?
All Fleck, yeah. As we ran in, our number two, we were leading. Our crew were leading. Parsons was leading. Our number two were 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. See, that was the position of the box. Our number two was up like that. His bomb doors were open. And I looked up. Oh, Christ, he's going to hit us. How he missed us, I never know, you know. And he went straight in, you know, with his bomb load on. Our number five had smoke coming out of both engines, you know, as we were leaving the target. Never saw no more of him. Our number four just disintegrated like that after we left the target. We got a direct hit, just blew out. Number six went down on a coal mine in France. Got back to, you know, France anyway, hit a coal mine, went down there. And number three got in at Brussels with 3 wounded out of 4 on board. And we had 40 holes in our aircraft, and that was the time this flat went in my boot. And didn't scratch the skin, you know, come through the aircraft and went in the boot. That was I was very wary after flak after that, you know. Because you only had one mid-upper turret on a Mitchell, on a Mark II Mitchell, see. And then you had two guns, one pointing out of port, one pointing out of starboard, you know, .5s, just a single gun. Well, the other gunner had to operate those two guns, you know, see. The turret gunner, he was the gunnery leader of the box. You know, if you were attacked by fighters, he had to give all the orders. When they, January 45, they brought the Mark, we got hold of the Mark III Mitchell, which had a two-gun rear turret. So I went, or maybe went in the rear turret, and Ken went in the mid-upper, see. Now, if I couldn't see it, Ken used to take over. We had Glenn Martin, was it Glenn Martin turrets, or was it the other lot? They were .5s. If I couldn't see the fighters, you know, so when you're flying along and they come up like that and I can't see them, but Ken could, he took over the wording. See, what you did, if they attacked you on the port, 2 and 5, see, and 1 could have a go at them as they're coming up, see. Once they've passed you, 3 and 6 could have a go at them. See what I mean?
You're talking about the gun numbers or the plane numbers?
Plane numbers. See, if you're flying along like that and they're coming down there, see, 2 and 5 and 4 can have a go at them coming up. Mm. Once they've passed you, 3 and 6, because they had mid-upper turrets on all these aircraft, see, could have a go at them as they were going past you, you know, going up. Mm. See. Mm. Well, someone had to give their orders, you know. You could say 2, 5, you know, open fire, 4, open fire, see. And then they're coming past us, 3 and 6, get ready, you know, have your guns at a certain angle, you've got to hit them. See, and the gun releases had to know this, see.
Because that was the tactics used by the Americans in daylight bombing,
wasn't it? Yeah, more or less.
Yeah.
See?
Box defence.
Yeah, box defence, see. Because you've got a maximum number of guns, you know, in the smallest kind of bullet pattern, you know, and .5s were twice as big as a .303. See, but we never got caught by fighters. And you had a fighter escort 5,000 feet above you. You never saw them. You often wondered whether they were there because you can never see them. And you're supposed to have a close escort squadron, you know, Spitfires. Mm. But only once or twice I saw them, you know. I don't know where they were, but I finished up doing 31 on them. 31 on that lot, you know.
Were they equally horrifying moments?
In some cases they were worse, because when you saw a bloke going down, you know, out of your own box, you knew who it was. At night time, you see an Halifax go down, you didn't even know he was on your squadron or not. Didn't know who he was. See, so, it was... and as you could see more, it was a bit too more close at home, like, you know, if you know what I mean, it's a bit nearer to you. Yeah, but and blokes are just at your wingtip. And of course, a Mitchell's half the size of an Halifax, you know. You know, 30 feet away, and he's... It could have been you. So in some ways, it was worse. You know, it's like the I've got a lot of time for the Americans, Air Force, you know, they're eight. Because they got... they did a hell of an eye in, you know. They thought they were going to, you know, end the war in about 2 weeks. Because you know, they had no idea, did they? Just didn't realise that the German will keep on and on and on at you, you know. They never give up, yeah.
So but how long were you on the Mitchells for then? Through to the end, or...?
Yeah, right until April 45. And then I went to... finished the 30 there, and I went to... it was this atomic place down near Reading.
Aldermaston?
No, not Aldermaston, the other one. So, it's on the main Oxford M4 road.
Old Didcot area, isn't it? Abingdon?
Not far from Abingdon. 5 or 6 miles from Abingdon. It's now...
Cullum?
It's now an atomic place.
Cullum?
No. But that was an airdrome. That was a Mitchell... Another Mitchell OTU. And I was made instructor, you know, went there as an instructor. And that was another farce, you know, and that was one of the Air Force cock-ups. All the blokes who were coming through were all sergeants. They had done a gunnery course. And you had to take three of them up at a time. And you had a couple of Spitfires, what they called fighter affiliation, you know, attacking you. And you had to... You got in the turret, Spitfires attacked you, and you told the these three pupils, three sergeants, what to do, you know, to get out of the way, you know. Well, it was hopeless, wasn't it? Because the pupils were either Dutchmen, Frenchmen, Poles. And it was hopeless. And when you got back, the flight lieutenant said, how are they? Well, you've got to pass them. Why? Well, they did ball out bandit. So you knew they... And then they go off in their own language, because these fighters used to come right really close, like, you know, you know, frighten the life out of them. But they balled out bandit, so they'd seen it. After that, I don't know what they said. It was ridiculous. So, really, it was a couple of months, it was a sky, really. It was a joke, really.
And so you were there up to August when the war ended?
Yeah, I was there.
What about your own life during the war? Had you got married or anything?
Nah. No. Wouldn't have none of that. Oh, dear.
But you had parents, presumably? Or,
Oh, yeah.
Did you see much of them? Or?
Not a lot. Yeah, my mother and sisters were evacuated down at the other side of Bristol there, in 40. And I had some old aunt, you know, and they opted down there. The old man, he was in the police force, so, he had to stay. Stay until the war was over.
As an ex-airman himself, was he interested in what you were doing?
Or? Oh, yeah. I used to go and see him, you know, come home to London when I used to get leave. Come home, how many you done, and all this lark, you know. What's it like?
What were your feelings? I mean, when you were actually on ops and you knew your mates were going and you were saying sometimes a squadron would lose a hell of a lot of planes on one trip, what were your own feelings? I mean, did you live from day to day or what?
Yeah. It was definitely a day-to-day basis. Because you'd be dead at the end of the week. Especially on 78 squadron. We lost 5 out of 6 at Flensburg, then we had a lovely run till the end of February 43. Flensburg was October 42. We lost about 4 or 5 aircraft in that time. And in fact, in February 43, 78 Squadron put up the record for Bomber Command. 196 sorties, no loss. And that was the last time. From then on, they lost 3 a night or more. 4, a couple of sixes, I think. 2 or 3 5s, you know, different. Right to the end of the war. That they are them. There was a Lank Squadron, or was it one? I think it was 1, 4, 9, and 10 Squadron. Or was it 102 Squadron? No, 102 Squadron. 78, 102, and a Lank Squadron. I think it was 1, 4, 9. I'm not too sure. Those three squadrons had the highest losses of all Bomber Command through the war.
And of those crews who were lost, I mean, how many managed to get out and became prisoners?
Well, when Minnie came back, he said there was they were going to form a 1 in 12 club, POWs. So there's about 1 in 12 got away with it. The rest got killed.
Was that because the plane blew up, or they didn't get a chance to go out?
Yeah, see, if it's on fire and you're like that, you've got chances of getting out. You've only got seconds to do it anyway. As soon as it goes down like that, you'll never get out because you can't even lift your arm.
Because of the G.
Yeah, the G. We got caught by searchlights one night with Mills, down he's gone. I didn't know he was going to pull out. I thought he wouldn't pull out, but he did. And he dropped about 12,000 feet. And when he pulled out, I hit the roof of the turret. You know, you're weightless. So you pulled out. But going down, I couldn't even lift my arm. So once the aircraft started going down, you'd had it, and none of them got out, you know.
And hatches didn't open and things like that.
Yeah, see. Some of them were really lucky blokes. I mean, we had a fella from Leicester, air gunner on Lanks, and he opted at 18,000 feet, no shoot. Aircraft was on fire, his chute was burnt, so he jumped, and he got away with it.
Well, did he land in a tree or something?
Hit a tree and went into a 20-foot snowdrift. And he lay there about 3 days, I think, before they found him. And the German medical service couldn't believe it, and they kept him in hospital for 12 months. Yeah, he broke most of the bones in his body, like, you know, but he got away with it. And they gave him a certificate at the finish. Yeah, I've seen it. He used to bring it up. He died about 3 or 4 years back. He used to come to the Air Gunners reunion every year. I mean, another bloke I know, Canadian. He was on 76, this fella. It was either Essen or Cologne. They had to bail out over the target. And he landed right on the top of a 180-foot chimney. All through the ride, this thing was going like that. And a German corporal on leave or something, anyway, the German corporal climbed up and got him down. That's an experience. Couldn't believe it. Oh, so some of them had miraculous escapes. And then one of the best was on Mitchell's, he was French Canadian. What was his name? I can't recall his name now. We went to Venlo. Venlo was a bridge. We always lost one or two there. The flak there was pretty accurate, you know, and good. And he was in the leading aircraft. And what they did on these Mark II missiles, sometimes they put a blister in the leading aircraft, and you had a gunner laying down, looking down, you know, for direct ammo. They got a direct hit. And at 7,000 feet, the aircraft broke up like that. Just snapped in two, you know. Well, this bloke was lying in this rear, because they had no rear turret on the Mark II. And what had done, the air created a vacuum. And he couldn't fall out. And it floated down like that.
Like a leaf.
Yeah. Sprained ankle, prisoner of war. This was December 44 when that happened. And Coty, that was his name. C-O-T-Y with an accent on the Y or something, or an E. And he just married a Scotch woman, Scotch girl. And they were the blokes you never flew with. You never flew with a bloke, just got engaged, just got married. He married, yeah, his wife's just had a baby. Don't fly with him, he ain't going to live. And all three squadrons I was on, that applied. They seem to have got the blokes who had everything to live for, bought it. Seems incredible, doesn't it?
But not everyone got off his crew.
Oh, no, but it always seemed to be the bloke who just got married, you know. Don't fly with him, he's just got married, he ain't going to live long. He'd buy it. Seemed incredible, that, to me, you know. So you never got too deeply involved with any one woman, you know. If you did. You know how women are, you know, go and get an engagement ring, start looking in furniture shops and all that lark, you know, away. And that all, especially on 78, that, yeah, at Linton, when we moved from Middleton, we went to Linton, both squadrons, seemed to happen on both squadrons that, you know, bloke just got married, don't fly with him, he ain't going to live long, yeah, and it seemed that.
Did you sleep well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Used to have any bad dreams or anything?
Nah. But used to drink a lot. You know, I mean, you get out to your aircraft and they give you a double red, you know. Ops off, scrubbed. Too late, especially in summertime, you know, it'd be 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, back in the mess. And I've drunk all night. Just before they shut the bar, see, have the officers in. If they got the CO in, he could give you an extra hour on the bar, so you extend it till midnight. See. Just before midnight, everybody would dive up and buy a crate, 24 halves in a crate, you know. Drink till 7 o'clock in the morning, walk straight in and have breakfast. That happened on more than one occasion. Oh, you drunk a lot. Because you never knew, you know, you felt, well, next time I might not have a drink. This time next week I'll be dead.
Did you get off the base a lot, down the local town?
Yeah, if you could, you know, if there were no ops on, you could get off, you know. You didn't need a pass or all that. Airmen had to have passes, but sergeants didn't, you know. You know, you could go into York, as long as you were back next day, you know. That invariably resulted in a fight with the army, because York was army town, you know. You had one or two fights with the army, finished up in the local brig.
Did you get involved?
Yeah, oh, two or three occasions. And you either went, it all depended on the sergeant or the inspector in charge at night, you know. Because 9 times out of 10, they used to throw you out, you know, about 3 or 4 in the morning. Well, in York, especially in December, and if you had a fight, you know, your overcoat was in the pub. You had no overcoat, and these cops used to throw you out about 4 o'clock in the morning, and there wasn't anything open in York, not even on the railway station, you know, because you froze. Yeah, they'd teach them, because they knew you had to go back to the pub, you know, about 9 o'clock to get your overcoat. you were freezing. There was nowhere in York, you know, no red shield open, nothing, you know. Another bloke, a charger, you know, causing a fray or whatever they called it, you know, disturbance. See, find a pound, you know. And Cheshire used to send a fella down, he was a pilot officer, this bloke. I think he was training to be a lawyer, this bloke, and he'd get up and these boys are flying over Germany night after night, and you know, they unfortunately they got one too many and let their hair down, and you know, they were insulted by the army. Pound, yeah.
What's this red shield you referred to?
Well, it was like it was an army mob. It was like the Salvation Army, and most like a Halton had a big hut, and you could go in there and buy a cup of tea and a wad, you know, for about a penny, you know, tuppence, a penny.
Like
the
Tok H or
something. Yeah, yeah, like Tok H, yeah, and you know, a cup of tea, penny, and cup of wad, penny, you know, yeah, if you've got a couple of. currents in it, you've done well. You know. It was a religious organisation, yeah, it was like TOC H, Salvation Army, they used to, Red Shield they used to call it, yeah. But they had places all over the shop.
What was the civilian population like towards you, were they?
Oh, good. Oh, air crew. You couldn't go wrong. Couldn't go wrong. We went into Leeds, first time we went into Leeds was around September 42. We got into Leeds, got a weekend off. And this was a Saturday, dinner time. And we went into a restaurant in Leeds called Hagenbalch. You went upstairs, and they still insisted, this is the middle of the war, 42, white tablecloth, silver service. Couldn't believe it. And waitresses. I couldn't believe it. Christ, in the middle of a war. It was in peacetime. Hadn't stopped. And what they used to do, all of it was rations, egg and chips. They used to give you a great big pile of chips, and I had the egg underneath the chips, so Simmies couldn't see it. And they charge you about, for that, and two slices of bread and a cup of tea, I think it was about 11 pence, old money. Hey. And when we went up to pay the bill, there was about four of us, first time we ever went there, that bill's paid. We've got one and tuppence or something like that. Will you accept that in cigarettes? Certainly. Somebody had paid the bill. Never seen it. Never did it. Ever, find out whoever it was. Could have been the proprietor. Because we were the first air crew in Leeds, in 42. Canadians had been in there, before. But we were the first air crew in Leeds. See? The same when we were at Middleton. I saw a thing I've never seen since. We went to Middlesbrough. You were Stockton, Darlington and Middlesbrough were the three towns from Middleton St George that you went in. And we were billeted at Dinsdale Hall, which was some ship owner's mansion or something. 78 squadron were up there, 76 were on the drone. And Dinsdale was a little station, and they used to put an aircrew bus there to wait for the last trains from Stockton, Darlington and Middlesbrough. So where are we going? We've got the night out. Go to Middlesbrough, into Middlesbrough. Steel town, big steel mills. And we're looking for a pub. This is near enough 5 o'clock in the evening. We come to one pub, right near the steelworks. And in those days, those old-fashioned pubs, you couldn't see through the windows, it was all frosted glass, wasn't it? They'd have the name of the brewery, We're looking over, and the governor is pouring pubs, right the length of the long bar, right the length. Three in a row. Are we not? Anyway, he come out, you see we were air gunners, in. See? So he gives him a mic, what are you doing, mate? He said, when them steel fellas come out of there, he said, everyone knows his place. He said, they've got 3 pints. He said, you watch them. He said, they'll be down in 2 minutes, he said. They'll drink the 3 pints. We'll never heard of this. Why? He said, they lose so much sweat. They're working in over 100 degrees. He said, this is the only thing that puts them back. So I thought myself, you're earning a lot of money. I said, because in London, half the pubs were shut. See, because of beer shortage. I said, no. Oh, no, he said, no steel town where there's mills, steel mills, go short of beer. He said, they've got priority over everybody else. Oh, well, As soon as these steel blokes walked in, he was right. They lined the bar up, and they turned around and they saw us, and we were legless by about 9 o'clock, and we never spent a penny.